best advice to a small business owner, or for that matter, to a large business owner, is never stop thinking about how to delight your customer. Not to satisfy your customer, but to delight your customer. And when you wake up in the morning, start thinking about it. During the day, think about it. At night, think about it, and then dream about it. And no company's ever failed that had millions of delighted customers. And you start with them and you get them one at a time.
That's Warren Buffett offering advice to small business owners via a video from Goldman Sachs. The business I will look at in this episode of Business Leader wants to power the growth of small businesses, but it has to take on a big industry to do so. I'm Graham Ruddick, and this is Business Leader, a podcast that takes a second look at big business stories. In this episode, I speak to Oliver Prill about how a German economist is trying to disrupt the banking industry in the UK as the chief executive of Tide. Tide was founded in 2015 by George Beavis. It's a financial technology business that offers online banking services to small and medium-sized businesses. George Beavis brought in Oliver Prill as chief executive to drive the growth of the business in 2018. Since then, Tide has grown rapidly. Around 1 in 10 of the 5.5 million small businesses in the UK now use Tide. One of the services it offers is actually registering the creation of new businesses on Companies House. No one else does this more in the UK. Tide is a business at the front line of the economy.
I think what happened in my background, right, is that being German, sort of, it was important to do something academic. And then at least my generation of Germans still have this thing of doing a doctorate. That's where you see a lot of people in business doing doctorate. I was probably the only person in Oxford slaving through a DPhil that didn't want to be in academia. And anyway, so I never had that intention, but I do, you know, I did do the hard work on economics. Then going into business, really, I learned very quickly, having worked for McKinsey, where I started out, that I actually quite like changing things. And I like, you know, what today would be called probably including breaking a few things and changing markets. I quite enjoyed that. And so when I had the opportunity from McKinsey to sort of move in what was then .com phase one, if you want, I was able to go into Direct Line and really help them get into e-commerce, right? It was today probably inconceivable, but Direct Line hardly had a website at that stage. It's really so from them onwards, I always did the unusual thing. So, I did Direct Line e-commerce, then basically web-based insurance sales. Then within the Royal Bank Group, I then ran Continental Europe, which was sort of a direct business. And then I decided, I was quite young at this stage, why not actually do something more radical, actually do a startup. And so I basically built a bank with CNA Bank. And having exited that, the real question was, what's next? And so how did I end up with Tide after a few sort of interim steps opening other fintechs was really, I thought it was just a fantastic opportunity of disrupting the market. Tide at that stage was just starting out. It had made some sort of initial impact, but was still very, very small. And so I thought I could do something to give back to business owners who I'd admired from the beginning of being in business. And so, from there it went.
How did the job, you touched on it there, but how did the job come about? Because you obviously were the first CEO of the business to succeed the founder. Obviously, George brought you in. So what was that like?
Yeah, it was probably less dramatic than people imagine, right? So I was really sold this bank in Germany and was sort of going around to consulting fintechs, helped. Some of that stuff was quite interim-based, so I helped with Credit Tech and others. And I was approached by a headhunter who said, look, Tide is there. The founder is looking to move on, having really found something that can be scaled quite radically. Do you want to have a look? Seems to be exactly the sort of thing you like doing, disrupting. And that's how things, started about. So it was no exciting story of meeting in a pub one night, but it was really just a headhunter, making a phone call.
And then what happened from there? Presumably you met with George at one stage. What was that initial meeting like?
Yeah, so it was with him, but also remember we're in the startup scene, so investors, get of course quite interested in who runs the company they invested in. And so I met with George, but I also met with the key investors, with the leadership team. Clearly at that stage, the question of course is not only do they want you, but do you really believe, do I believe in the proposition? Do I think there are abilities? Clearly at any stage of scaling, there are challenges and there are opportunities. So in part, it was a lot of discussion around what is, the business model, how can we evolve the business model? How can we really turn this into something that is quite large? And some of the answers were there. Some of them clearly weren't there. That's why they were looking for someone to help scaling it. But I walked out of the discussion in particular with George, was that fundamentally the idea that there is a big community of small business people that don't have a finance function, that are burdened with all this finance and admin stuff that no one really likes, and that there is an app that helps them solve that so that they can go back to what they love, really, really appeal to me. And something that we've never changed in the core. Clearly, we changed a lot of how we deliver it. We've become much, much more sophisticated. But in terms of the core bit of what we're doing, which is to help customers, we call them members. That was the other big thing that I found very attractive, to help members save time and money so they can actually run their business. Very much appealed to me.
What was the business you found when you joined? What was it? What was there?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? So you look at Tide today, you look at some numbers that we have now, 580,000 members, 10% of the UK market. At that stage, I think we had something like 15,000 members, right? So it was much, much smaller. I think we've got now something like 1,600 people working for Tide. At that stage, I think we had just passed 40, so 40. So it was a very, very small business, like any very early stage startups. A lot of highly motivated, energetic people moving things forward, but not necessarily with the skills or in a structure that allowed easy scaling, right? So, I liked from the very beginning the very strong culture that Tide had, very non-political, very can-do, very empathetic to its businesses, the customers, right? So I really enjoyed that. But clearly there were big challenges around getting all the financial resources the business needed, professionalizing a lot of processes and structures, bringing in the right people that could scale, and doing all of that without destroying the soul of the business, which of course, was the thing that created the early successes in Tide.
How do you look back on that business today? How much has Tide changed?
Completely. We actually, what you'll see around here, on voice, but if you looked around, we have a new office, and actually part of moving offices is always reflecting on how many offices have we been in, how much have we changed. And so at that stage in London, it was very common, probably still is very common as early startups, you have the tail end of a lease, right? So you take a lease and you have 6 months to 9 months to 12 months left. Someone has moved out and you get a discount on the rent. So we were in St. John Street and then White Bear Yard, sort of tail end of the leases, moving every year, having some of the furniture would have been secondhand. Of course, now you look around the office, we've got a nice net zero office. We have, modern, great new desk, all the equipments that you could dream of. So, from visual of the office to the people, we've changed a lot, right? In terms of the people, at that stage, everyone was based in London. We would have had very young and enthusiastic people that moved us forward. We now hopefully still have that in many parts, but we've got people that have much more, experience in many, many parts. We have, of course, all the structures you would expect from a company. So, the business has moved on a lot in terms of its organization design.
When Oliver Prill joined Tide, it meant that he was succeeding the founder of the business as chief executive. That posed some unique challenges for him as Tide looked to grow.
So he still sits on our board probably once a month. We have dinner from time to time. I think I've clearly not taken over from founders very often. So this is my only experience. So I can only talk to what I see from, we see around us. And I think there are three types of founders when they move on, right? There are those that say, look, I've really found something. I'm really proud that I was the early founder, but I'm really looking for someone else to scale it. I'm just not the right person for various reasons, skill or will. The second one is the sort of person that it sort of understands, but is not willing to move on. And so keeps giving tons of advice. And then I think the third one is where, you know, a founder has been asked to move on by investors. George is very much in the first camp, right? So he's there. He is always willing to give advice and to support. But, you know, he's taking the decision that he was not the person to scale. And therefore, you know, being on the back of the CEO of the day, was probably something that he thought was not particularly helpful. It probably would not have been particularly helpful. However, I do find it helpful to discuss with him, you know, just some of the principles that we have, you know, how we think of members. We had a discussion, for example, at some stage, we actually dropped the term member, you know, and we had a good discussion. He had a lot of input of why that was at the beginning with the strong signaling that has both to the market, but also internally to our Tidians. And so these sorts of things he's a great sounding board for. He probably would see himself less as someone that that is the right person to give advice to scale businesses at scale, just purely because he's decided that that is not for him. So, generally great relationship.
How important for the success of this business was it that decision was taken, that he brought in someone as a chief executive?
So yeah, of course, I would impart, right? You're asking, like, the person that can't give you a completely unbiased answer, right? So, of course, I would have said, you know, I made a huge difference and I would love to look back on Tide and say, you know, this is beyond my wildest dreams. And it was, right? If I sort of look back to the presentation I did to the board when I joined of where we could end up, I still remember people saying, Oliver, you will never reach 1% market share. If I told them we would be above 10%, right, they would have thought, cloud cuckoo land. In part, of course, you know, I will attribute this to my leadership. Now, objectively, I think if I try to abstract from it, in the core, we are still executing against the original mission, right, that we done. And, you know, George takes credit for that. Could someone else have scaled it at this level? I'm not sure, right? But hopefully I've had at least a small contribution to getting us here.
What is the key for you as a chief executive to succeed a founder like that? Because it's a role that I guess isn't for everyone, and some people may be wary about it. Does it take some special skills to make it work?
It's a really interesting question, right? And there's a sort of founder ethos, and you know there are lots of stories around where it worked well and where it worked badly. I think one of the things to consider is when did the founder decide to move on? So Tide was really very, very small. So I think we probably have, of the 40 people that were there, I would guess a little bit over a handful left, right? The rest of it would have moved on, not because we exited them, but just, you know, businesses have turnover and people sort of move on. So we have very few people that remember that time. However, I think where it became more relevant. So today, I would argue it's probably not as relevant. People will just say it's a reasonably scaled business and there's a CEO running it. And, you know, hopefully most people will be delighted with my leadership. But at the time of George moving on, it was a shock, right? Because people often don't understand these things, right? They were brought in. They were, of course, as early in early stages, you join a company often by the charisma of the leader that runs it. The founder is very closely associated with the mission. So when we had these a little bit under 40 people when I joined, for them, I'm sure it was a bit of a shock, right? And then, of course, the guy comes in that is more of a scale person, right, that tells them about all these dreams of where to go, starts making changes. That's hard on people. I spend a lot of time trying to bring people, you know, along. A lot of these discussions were not only around the founder and the personality and all that ethos that comes with it, but also remember, part of it was to really get Tide ready to scale. So suddenly structure, processes, new people are being brought in, processes, structures are being amended. I'm sure it was a bit of a culture shock for people. And we spend a lot of time trying to get people's buy-in. And in my mind, that worked reasonably well. However, I'm sure that there is some sort of reflection, nostalgic reflection by some people that remember the kitchen table. And I'm sure there was a great time when that would have really worked. But if we had stayed with that, we probably would not have reached the scale.
In that situation where you're succeeding the founder, do you find yourself having to ever explain that, the ambitions for this business are as big as ever. He's not standing aside because he doesn't believe in it anymore. He's standing aside because he wants us to help grow.
So in my mind, there's always two bits, right? Especially to the British soul, right? In the end, we're a British company, maybe a German, British CEO. But, there is a bit to the thing, to the British soul that sort of says, yes, that's what they tell us. But, is that really what's true? So it's very important George decided and announced that he's moving on before I joined, right? So the two things were a little bit time-wise removed. He also remained an investor. And so, I think people in part will look at, he still believes in it and he's still got his money in it. However, I'm sure there were people that needed convincing, right? And that's what I'm saying. I think the first sort of couple of months, maybe a year, was a bit more challenging. Once we broke through the 100,000, the 1% market share, people sort of got a little bit quieter because they just saw that the numbers were starting to speak for themselves. But I'm sure there were a lot of people that found that hard. And I would say for people that are listening and that are sort of saying, how easy is a transition? I don't think these transitions are that easy. It's clearly about bringing someone in that has to be sensitive. I try to be very sensitive. On the other hand, you do need to come in and you need to do things differently because that's the whole point of why the founder, stood back, so the business could be scaled. So, it's a fine balance.
How long did it take you to get into a position where you felt you had the team around you that could drive the business forward? Because presumably you take the job and you inherit a business that's been built around the founder. So how long does it take you to get to a position where it looks like the way you want to build it?
Well, probably we're not even there yet, right? The ambitions are bigger and, we were changing all the time. So hard to understand, this is a continuous journey. And I think this is one of the big things at Tide, but also my previous jobs, I find that people don't really understand, right? Or don't internalize. Structures are always transient, right? Every organizational design needs to be adjusting. So we adjusted when we started to go international. Before that, we had to adjust when we scaled, when we added new products. Every time there's an adjustment where in people's psychology, there's something in human psychology that looks for stability and permanency and sort of says, isn't that great? That's the organizational design that's going to stay, right? So, and with it then in the organizational design. So in part, the way we try to deal with this at Tide, or I try to deal with this, is trying to get people's buy-in and understanding, right? And I think the fundamental thing that is often alien to people is the idea that there's structure as a strategy structure people, right? So a very basic concept, you define your strategy without your business plan, your roadmaps, et cetera, right? And that should, in the end, drive how you're structured. And with that structure, you then need to bring the right people in, right? And when you go the other way around, I design structures around them, and then that structure dictates the strategy. That's usually, a recipe for failure. So we've been trying to live with that principle. We spend a lot of time at Tide trying to get people to understand these patterns, these ways of thinking. And so in part, that dictated how we did changes. So we had some very quick changes because I came in and clearly the idea was to quickly change, adjust things to scale the business, address some of the challenges that were around, in part to get the business ready for the next fundraise, right? That was part where, Tide is and was an investor-funded business. And so around that, we communicated, these are the steps we're taking. For that, we need to make these structural changes. These people we're bringing in. But I also try to be very open that as we grow, we continuously bring in new people. So take a good example. Last year, we hired our first CPO, right? That was 5 years after I joined, right? And he will not be the last sort of leader we're bringing. We're bringing a lot of talent in as we scale the business. And people need to sort of internalize that. And so to answer your question, how long did it take to have a team around me? Probably it took a year to get some of the core people in place, but it's a permanent process. And also my team and the broader leadership team needs to realize that as the strategy evolves, as we scale, as the challenges and the opportunities arise, we need to change structure, and that will mean we need to also bring in, you know, additional talent where required.
Oliver Prill has led the growth of Tide from being a promising business in 2018 into one that is close to becoming a unicorn, which is a technology business valued at $1 billion or more. Tide has got 10% of the UK market for small businesses, as you have heard. And it's also expanded into India and Germany. But could it have grown faster?
I think the first thing is we spend time, not necessarily a lot of time, but time really defining our strategy, right? And I think what a lot of people get confused about is strategy versus agile. So maybe let me quickly talk about that, right? So agile really in its core is the idea is when I get insights, you know, I adjust to these insights. We completely buy into that. But what I realized very early on is if you just go out, you build something, you get insights, you just don't know where your north star is. You don't know where this whole thing develops. And so we always started off with what we internally call, you have to understand the Rolls Royce. So what are you ultimately building? What's your target state? And then we roll back from the target state. And we actually have a model that we call the three horizon. Right. So if you were, you know, the company overall, but also you as a leader within the company, if you control an area, you have to articulate to yourself in and to the broader organization what you're doing, your strategy in three horizons. Horizon three is the target state. Right. So where do you want to aim to? Where do you want to get to? Horizon two is the plannable, foreseeable, you know, planning cycle, which we call 5 quarters. So the current quarter plus 4 quarters. And then we've got Horizon one, which is really about hardcore execution, which is the immediate quarter we're in. And then in terms of where we're heading, we're basically aligning all three horizons. So in horizon three, we say, this is the target state. We only adjust the target state if, you know, something we really have new data. Otherwise, it's locked and not up for discussion. We only unlock it when it's right, when there's new data, then we unlock it and we relock it. We then have, next to the target state, a path two, which is this horizon two. Again, you have a 5-quarter roadmap. We've got 5-quarter plan, financial plans, all of that aligned, hiring plans, resourcing plans. And again, in these 5 quarters, if we learn something new in terms of what sequence we want to do things, some things were better than others, we adjust. Then you've got the immediate quarter, which you're in, which is really not around replanning. Right? You replan only if you absolutely have to, but it's about relentless execution against it and tactical adjustments to make sure that your execution works. So we work on these three horizons, and that has served the company very well. Because that means people have a feeling, they have an understanding where things are heading, they understand under what circumstances we adjust, but they also understand that in the short term, it's not about forgetting what I said yesterday, but it's delivering against the promises and trying to sort of make up any deficits that come your way, you know, because we all know no plan sort of survives the contact with reality, right? It always needs some degree of adjustment.
Why and when did you decide to expand Tide overseas? And why did you choose the markets that you did?
Yeah, it's a good question. We are a little bit later on that. That's probably the one example I would give where we've been slower than others. And maybe the sort of first sort of thing is why even abroad, right? Because that's how we start in Horizon 3. Why would you look at that, right? And we sort of said, look, in the end, the UK is a confined market. We've got, you know, 5.5 million SMEs. It's unlikely to radically grow. You know, it's a reasonably stagnant market. And so at a stage, you have to ask yourself the question, how big can we get, right? So, you know, at A level, you know, as I said, when we had less than 1% market share, all the investors were saying, well, Oliver, you know, stop dreaming. You're not going to get over 1, 2, or 3. And now that we're over 10, people are asking, well, how much bigger can you get, right? Because at some stage, you know, this is not a search engine territory. No one will ever have 80, 90% market share in the SME. So at A level, we needed to sort of meet the condition of, you know, having a solid UK position in terms of market share. The second thing that drove us, though, was we really disliked, even during the sort of crazy funding days, the idea of being loss-making everywhere. So we worked very, very hard of making the UK business cash generative. And only really once we started to generate cash in the UK, we said, let us go abroad. And so For us, that was what drove looking into the markets. Let me come back to markets. Before actually going into markets, we had the challenge of how to scale the business. So at a stage, we realized that in the UK, hiring product engineering talent at scale was very, very hard. You know, Brexit complicated that. But even before Brexit, you know, it's a very hot market. People are moving very quickly. And so we started building engineering and product engineering centers in Sofia and in Hyderabad in India, just because of the depth of the talent, not really with a mind of going into those markets. It was just the only way we could at that stage attract the volume of product engineering talent. And with that, we were able then to also add some operational capacities and so on. And so we understood India really, really well. And so when we then turned it to, well, look at the UK, where would you go next? We sort of said, well, you know, with the business model that we've got, I mean, we'll come back to our business model in a moment, the platform-based business model, what makes a lot of sense is to be in larger markets, right? So we basically, our model really works well when there's a lot of volume going through the platform. We said to maximize the leverage, operational leverage of that platform, we said, let's stay with one platform globally and then customize it as we go into markets. So we then said, well, the obvious one is to actually go into the largest market, which happened to be India. You know, it sounds far away, but we had a lot of confidence around it because, you know, a lot of product engineering talent of Tide was already India-based. Then when we look closer at India, not only was India really, really large, but also, you know, in terms of the digitization trend, unbelievable volumes, right? So even the formalized SME sector in India is 35 million, which is all of continental Europe put together, right? So that's the formalized sector. India believes it has 64 million SMEs. If you look at official statistics, we actually believe it's closer to 10% of the population, so about 140 million SMEs, because 10% is typically the benchmark of how big the SME sector is to the population. And so India is just an enormous market that has established businesses that are already formalized. And then there's this enormous formalization trend happening in India where people are adopting the web-based services and scale-up-based services, UPI, platform IDs, allowing easy identification, KYC. So India, in many ways, is today quite advanced technically, maybe even more advanced than the UK and continental Europe in many aspects. And so that drove us to India. So that was the first market we entered. And then the second market we just announced outside the UK was closer to home. So we said next to the UK, whether we like it or not, across the channel, there's still continental Europe. 70% of UK trade is with continental Europe, and it's, you know, reasonably proximate. And so we said as a second sort of play is continental Europe, starting with Germany. Why Germany? One is it is the largest market, but clearly also one that I know personally quite well. And so we believe that's lower risk. You'll see there's a bit of a common trend in India. We have a lot of institutional knowledge from the people we've got there, Germany, with myself and certain other people in the broader leadership team. We understand as a market quite well. So that's the second market we're entering, and then we'll see where that takes us in continental Europe. So that's really what drove us internationally.
Banking has traditionally been a sector that's been difficult to disrupt, both in the market for consumers and in the market for businesses. Oliver Prill is concerned that regulators could hold back innovation.
We estimate when Tide started, around 3% of all business current accounts were with challengers. We think today we have something like 35 to 40%. So Tide has been part of a disruption, but the scenario that you described in the early days, that was exactly it. And the reason why the sector was quite hard to crack is that unlike in consumer, people don't really switch, right? So you select your banking provider when you start. And also what's very different to consumers, people don't have a lot of banking relationships. So I'm not sure how many you have, maybe you're also not representative, and I'm definitely not representative, but I've got over 10 bank accounts, personal bank accounts, because I try all of them. But even the normal person would have a Monzo, Revolut, in addition to their Barclays, HSBC, and so on. Small businesses don't really do that. And the reason why they don't have many banking relationships is they don't want to spread their liquidity. They're quite nervous about not having enough cash to pay their bills and so on. So they don't really want to spread it. And so you are in a scenario where people, when they start out, basically form the banking relationship with one bank and then tend to stay. And then what happens is when they stay, they can't really get out of it. And so they, every year, when you look at statistics, there will be one survey that says 65% hate their bank, 60% will move within 12 months. And then you look at the actual switching statistic, 3% have done it. And the reason why they don't do it is that it's too hard, right, and not the current priority. So the key we realize to really disrupt this market, you need to help people when they start out in business, what we call new to market. And at that stage, people want to get into business. So we really fine-tune the proposition of how to get launched, never getting into, you know, the substance of their business, or how to tell a bakery how to bake and so on, right? But we basically help them set up their company, their accounts, all of that seamlessly and fast. And so with that, we started to capture share. And as these businesses started to be established, they became a larger and larger part. So that's the new to market part. The second one is we realized really, and that's really in the last 2 years, that also established businesses, while with the statistic I just quoted, they don't really want to hard switch. Hard switch in the sense of I close my HSBC account and come to Tide. They're very willing to engage with Tide. So with lending, with our credit solution, with our interest-bearing solution, people can now connect their third-party bank account using open banking into Tide. So they never really switched. I mean, if you want, virtually switch, but they can use Tide without actually switching, right? And so that's what we do. And in terms of why people switch and who switches, so in these two stages, established businesses and mutual market, it's really about always addressing the need of the business. So if you're established business, it's really around credit or savings, depending whether you've got cash or need cash. With a mutual market, the real thing is about getting going and having a good reputation, sort of a view that as you grow, this provider can help you solve all your problems in the future. And then the people we do serve are just people you see around. We reflect the UK without the corporates and mid-sized sectors. So we've got any businesses from Northern Ireland to Scotland, the regional distribution of the UK. You've got all sorts of sectors. Before the pandemic, we were a little bit underrepresented in cash-heavy sectors. But since the pandemic, clearly people don't really use cash that much anymore. And also people got a lot more used to going to the post office to deposit cash, which you can do with Tide. And so banks, of course, have been unhelpful or helpful, but from our perspective, unhelpful to business by closing all their branches. So in the end today, if you look at Tide, you know, we really reflect the UK pretty much in terms of sector and regional distribution.
What's your view on the UK as a place to do business, both to sort of found and also build and scale up a business?
That's a really interesting one. There's an interesting article by Dave Beard, the founder of FS11, that is saying, you know, London's fintech crown is slipping a little bit. And that's definitely true. I think what the UK often does is it's probably too negative about itself, right? I think the UK is a great place. I mean, look, as someone that has been, you know, has come to the UK, has really made a living here, you know, I love the UK and all the opportunities that it delivers. I think in the UK, in terms of doing business, what the challenges are, one is that there is a lot of negativity. Often in business, it's about confidence. And so if you speak long enough about all the things that are wrong, at some stage, people believe there must be something wrong if all the people talk where there's something wrong, right? So I think one is the negative sentiment. And in part, you know, with the negative sentiment that there are certain discussions that the society finds very hard to move on from Brexit and so on, right? I think these just need to be left behind us. Secondly, the society in the UK often finds it quite hard to prioritize, right? And so if you look at the tech scene, there are a lot of great initiatives that the government is taking. For example, the Mansion House Accord, right, which is a compact that is bringing pension fund investment into the tech sector, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of great initiatives. Often, though, they get diffused by so many noise and so many other things that are happening. So an interesting one, for example, is it more important to strengthen London internationally or to level up, right? In the UK, that would be a very controversial statement because people would say, well, everyone has the right to level up, but is it better to have a leveled up place that is mediocre internationally or to have London as a real strong fintech capital that is actually number one globally? I mean, I don't want to answer the question, but that's the sort of prioritization that needs to take. And then I think the third one is, in the UK, a lot of the regulators, the policymakers, so this special regulatory landscape, in the early days, I'm talking very much from a fintech perspective, we had very enlightened regulators that actually took risk, that sort of believed that introducing competition with controls is in the end the better way to actually achieve good consumer outcomes, rather than sort of dogmatic, in part nanny state type regulation. And the current generation of regulators have really gone back on that. And so we have a lot of regulations that are coming in. They're not necessarily wrong. Will they completely stifle investment? No, but they will make it a lot harder. And I think these three factors, I think the UK somehow needs to address. But nonetheless, you know, standing back, the UK is still a great place to do business. It is a major international economy with a lot of talent. The language itself is very helpful. Everyone speaks English, which is the international global language. And so I'm overall very positive about the UK. But there are a few things, you know, this government or maybe a future government does need to address.
Just on your point on prioritizing, why isn't it possible to both try and make London an international number one and level up the economy?
I think, look, in the end, life is all about priorities, and maybe one can do both, right? I'm not saying it can't. What I'm trying to say is, if I look at the sector, right? So if you go to the International FinTech Festival that will take place in the next couple of weeks, you will see people rolling off 10, 20 ideas, right? And in the end, what I think history has shown us, that countries that are very successful in terms of government policy have a few things that really move forward, right? Will dial forward. And so I also strongly believe in democracy. So I, as a business leader, should not tell policymakers what priorities to leverage. So, for example, if leveling up is more important than making London one, or maybe doing both of them in trade-off for some third or fourth priority, I think that's fine. What I'm trying to say is the problem is it doesn't become fine anymore if you try to placate everyone by saying, let me do 30 things, right? So we do all these other things. We do it. By the way, I gave you the example of trade-off between leveling up and London. Another great, you know, trade-off in our fintech world is between open banking and open finance, right? So there's a bit of saying we have open banking, which is all about current accounts and so on, right? And there's open finance, which would open up, you know, the sort of data economy to other financial instruments. Now, there is a question of, can you do both? Maybe the answer is you can do both. But open banking is still in many parts broken. Why would you start open finance, right? Or if you want to do both things, then you need to put all the resources behind it. And in the end, what at least I observe compared to other markets, we look at India as a good one, right, that we are very exposed to as Tide. Their policymakers take a few hard initiatives and really drive them home. Where in the UK, because of the compromise culture, we try to do many, many things in parallel and then are at risk of not doing, you know, any of them really well. And what I'm saying is, almost in a way, it's a democratic choice about which ones to prioritize. But what is just a truism is, if you don't prioritize and you try to do everything, the likelihood is that you deliver nothing that well, right? And so I think it's really more about prioritization than, you know, suggesting that, you know, what the specific priority is.
What does the future look like for Tide, and when can we expect you to float?
So first of all, I'm not sure whether float is the only, you know, only exit option. We've got investors, and so at some stage they want to exit. I have one. I told you about the very beginning of our thing, that we always have these patterns, right? That we try to, the principles that we try to adhere to. One of them actually is, we don't think of exit, we think of building a great business. And so, you know, it's not my job and it's not the job of the management team to define an exit and to enrich ourselves or anything like that. We just fundamentally want to build a great business and we think everything else will flow from it. So it's a philosophical thing. And I think that may in part account for our successes to date. At some stage, an exit will happen, whether that's a float, you know, an IPO or not. You know, it's too early to say. I definitely don't think it's around the corner. In terms of where Tide will be, I think I can talk a little bit more about that because it's a bit more concrete. So clearly in the UK, we will continue to grow and we will build out this platform. So I think at A level, market shares are finite, right? It's not a search engine territory, but we will grow a few more percentage points in the UK. But more importantly, we will just deliver an ever richer platform for SMEs in the UK. And then internationally, you know, we will aim to be in quite a lot of global reach, right? So we will go after markets that are sizable, that we can sort of be well ahead of 10% of global MSME in terms of the market, not market share, but in terms of markets in which we operate. And that is easier said than done, but, you know, we've got Germany coming around, and then, you know, there are you know, 4.5 markets that are meaningful in continental Europe in terms of size. And so those will probably be our next focus.
You've been listening to Business Leader with me, Graham Ruddick. Our producer is Anushka Tate. For more business interviews and analysis, please visit businessleader.co.uk or sign up for our daily newsletter, Off to Lunch, where you'll get a roundup of the business news and analysis that matters, plus updates when our new podcast episodes go live. You can sign up at businessleader.co.uk/newsletter.